This is Eli, aka Dr. Marshall, recording this asynchronous mini-lecture imperfectly on an Audio-Technica 2020 USB microphone. In the sense of imperfect, I'm focusing more on the message rather than the medium, I suppose, and I'm sorry about that. But I hope at least the musical examples herein may prove a little bit clearer than average streaming allows for, especially if you can download this. This microphone contains an onboard audio digital converter. It's consumer grade, $100 or so, but it's functional and worth thinking about as an affordable option for your home studio, along with the Zoom H lineup and so on. I'd like to gently remind you about Project One. The deadline is just a couple weeks away, and I'm officially making myself available to help with that project in particular, so please email me. Regarding Project One, I think the central question you're facing is how to make a piece of music or sound art. What elements of sound do you have control over? Today we'll talk about those elements of sound. In particular, we'll introduce frequency space, a term which encompasses timbre or sound color, and pitch. We'll distinguish frequency space from other elements such as pulse or rhythm and form. I'd like you to keep these four things in mind: timbre, pitch, pulse, and form, along with the fifth category you've already spoken about quite a bit, loudness. These four or five categories are cognitively distinct from each other, even though in fact they're interrelated. So when you listen to music, you can hear each one of these being manipulated. And when you make music, of course, you yourself have control over the manipulation, which is part of the answer to our first question: how to make a piece of music. You turn short ideas into a long piece by repeating, sort of repeating or varying them, or contrasting one idea to the next. All of this is done using the elements of loudness, timbre, pitch, pulse, form. That's about the most accurate advice I can give, but it's pretty clinical. Details change for every piece, every style, every creator. So let's talk about some real music now, which I hope will help you contemplate the thrust of Project One. Karim El-Dabd was 23 years old when he made this piece for a highbrow art gallery installation in Cairo. It was 1944. The whole world was, of course, embroiled in the awfulness of war. El-Dabd worked for a radio station and had pretty much the resources you have now. A field recorder. His was direct magnetic tape, yours is digital SD card. And facilities where he could cut, re-record, combine, add processing, whether physical or analog, in the form of reverberation, most notably. It probably took him hours or days, what might take us minutes now, so he had to be careful with his decisions in advance. In any case, this led to a fruitful life and career in Africa, Europe, North America as a leading composer. El-Dabd died just a few years ago as distinguished professor at Kent State University. But it's the 23-year-old El-Dabd that I want you to think about. He was in a similar position as you. he found a musical subject of interest, in his case, the Tsar ceremony, a ritual found in North Africa carrying, I read, important gender and social connotations in addition to religious or spiritual ones. So El-David collaborated with that sound material to make something originally 20 minutes long. What we're hearing here is an excerpt. I should note that with today's understanding, we can and probably should raise some semantic questions, from Orientalism to the ethnographic agency of taking a ritual out of context and so on. But for this particular class meeting, we can pretend to put those aside for now as we focus on the material, acoustic significance of El-David's working process and result. Those other questions are very valid and worthwhile to consider. I'd argue that by talking about how to hear the acoustic material that makes it onto tape, we can actually help those other scholars, the questioners of meaning in music, providing them with a firm foundation built on sound and allowing it to extend into the cultural significance, which is precisely what we do anyway when we create music. We create cultural significance. Let's return to the nuts and bolts question of making music. I'd like to reflect on what you already know how to do after 3 weeks in this class. It's really quite a bit. And also point out that you've been working with the parameters of loudness, timbre and pitch, pulse and form. So the skills you've acquired include recording and editing, composition in the concrete method, and a bit of songwriting and producing. These all draw on common skills. One of those common skills is to record anything, cut it pretty much anywhere, copy it, repeat it any number of times, change its volume, fading in, fading out. You can put those resulting objects sequentially on a track in any order. You can put any number of those tracks together, combine sounds simultaneously, mix them, change their levels. And you already know how to transform some of the elements I've already introduced today. Loudness, we just spoke of. The frequency domain, those two parameters of timbre and pitch, you already know how to alter this frequency domain in the DAW simply with the transpose function. You've also seen how to expand or compress duration, the playback speed as well. In the old days of concrete, those things, frequency and duration, were interconnected. Changing one also changed the other. But with these digital tricks, you can change the frequency and duration independent of each other. So you've done a lot in these first 3 weeks. It's gratifying to see how these skills come together. In the last lecture, week 3, Professor Ernst illustrated how to put together a multi-track piece as one performer or producer. That type of skill, recording and editing, are foundational. They're used in every recording studio around the world, and you'll use them the rest of your musical career. So let's listen to a few clips of music to highlight how some of these new concepts are manipulated. In the interest of time, I'll focus on the frequency space parameters, that is timbre and pitch. I'll occasionally mention pulse or rhythm, and sometimes address form, but primarily when getting back to El-David's piece. And Professor Ernst will also have a chance to speak about form in another context. I've chosen extra simple examples here where only one of these parameters typically is being altered at any one time, but the same questions can be applied to any musical texture. For example, your assignment 3 piece or your own creation project 1. Here's a little snippet from last week. You don't see a guitar, but when you hear this note, you know it's a guitar. That guitar sound, that's the timbre, the color, which exists in the higher frequencies of audible hearing. Very roughly here, that exists particularly around 1,000 hertz to 5,000 hertz and above. Rather than focusing on the guitarness now, can you sing back the pitch using your voice? Let me stress, not all sound contains a recognizable, singable pitch, but a lot of music you're familiar with probably does. Sometimes when we talk about pitch, we use the term fundamental frequency. Here, we experience the fundamental pitch as louder, more present than the timbre. So, all at once in this very, very short snippet of sound, barely long enough to be considered a musical object, we experience both timbre, the guitar color, and pitch, that stable thing that we can sing back. Together, those two aspects constitute the features of frequency space in this example. Taken altogether, it's easier now to hear that this is an example of music with a fairly unchanging timbre. That is, every note you hear is pretty similar. It's clear it's a guitar plucking, and it's doing so again and again. In fact, that constancy is something that is desirable. What is changing? Well, the fundamental pitch is changing from note to note. So essentially, we have an unchanging timbre and a changing pitch. That's the type of manipulation we can talk about, the pitch in particular. Keeping something the same, changing something else. Repetition, but variation in repetition. Picking at least one of those parameters to change, even if the other parameters stay pretty much the same. Let's turn to another sound. I'll start with a minimal duration like before to drive home the timbre and pitch perspective. So, what color profile does this have? Can you tell what instrument it is or what sound source it is? That's the timbre question. What about the pitch question? Does it have a fundamental pitch that you can sing back? I think the answer is yes. As for the timbre, that's very present. One qualitative word would be bright, used when there's a lot of overtone information, spectral information. A classic double reed sound. It's an instrument with variations all over Europe and Asia. In this case, it's a southern China suona. Now, despite the super bright spectrum, it does have a stable fundamental pitch, and you can quickly sing back whatever it's playing. What if we listen now to a longer segment? It's clear it's just the one instrument, pretty constant with its timbre, although notice how the timbre does change when it goes significantly higher than where it started in terms of pitch. That's one way in which pitch and timbre are interconnected. Here we're listening to a segment which is long enough to recognize, as with the guitar, a sequence of changing pitches. What about the pulse and rhythm information we have? It varies a little bit more than Professor Ernst's guitar demonstration. We have short notes, long notes, some rests, certain freedom there. But it is built out of a fairly regular, unchanging pulse. You could tap your foot to it, kind of stay at a steady tempo for the most part. But listen to those extra short moments of pitch and rhythm. Those are embellishments or ornaments, commonly referred to in the performing world. You might not even notice them at first, but They are vital to the sophistication and elegance of this type of music. We don't have time to listen to the phrasing here, but I can mention that much of the interest of this kind of music stems from the structure of the melody, the way in which, like a poem, certain lines are repeated, certain phrases are echoed. Before we move on to another segment, I'd like to interject one thing about this frequency space question, timbre and pitch. It's vital to think about this also when you're mixing. When you're coming up with new combinations of sounds, it becomes very important. Professor Ernst has also mentioned this in other sessions. There are different kinds of spatiality you can think of. Stereo and panning space. Frequency space is another one of those. High, middle, low. And there are tricks you can do with already recorded sounds if, say, two of them you want to coexist occupy too much of the same frequency space. The goal there is essentially to prevent them from blending too much in a bad way and encouraging either blend in a good way or separating out the sounds in some kind of distinct way. Now let's look at another kind of sound. Here's something from Billie Jean, which Professor Ernst referenced last week as well. Billie Jean, you may know, is a song by Michael Jackson and importantly was produced by Quincy Jones, who may have been responsible for the particular sounds here. I feel some responsibility to mention also that in music scholarship circles these days there's some discussion about whether to employ Michael Jackson in pedagogy given some recent sexual abuse allegations. Here I'll stress that it's important to keep that in mind, first of all, and second, again, that Quincy Jones was probably responsible for these particular sounds, although there was certainly a strong collaboration there. Nevertheless, we're stuck with this very influential piece of music, and let's consider just what is so powerful about it. You can hear how there's a fusion of, let's say, percussiveness or drumness. But each sound event, each pulse, let's say, occupies its own distinct frequency space. Even though there's not really any pitch you could sing back on any one of these sounds at any one moment, nevertheless, there's a basic concept of relative low, middle and high sounds. In some cases, they're sounding literally at the same time. In other cases, they're sounding in immediate sequence, one after the other. Fused together what might be called a groove in pop music. So this is where timbre and pitch concepts merge, this low, middle, highness. Here we can talk about the frequency domain as a single parameter, rather than bifurcating into pitch and timbre. What about the pulse? We certainly have a regular one. That's part of the power. This collection of pulses, in the end, becomes a kind of a phrase, and that would also catapult us into the area of form. By repeating this phrase, we end up talking about tens of seconds rather than milliseconds. So to assess this sample, regularly changing frequency sounds assembled into a highly repetitive pulse and phrase structure. Or if you're the one making music, you might think of it as assembling a series of colors and looping it. and eventually finding a way to vary it or stop it to do something else. Let's return to some sounds with fundamental pitches, but a little different than the ones before. The twist is, there is a fundamental pitch, but there's only one. It doesn't change. What does change this time is the timbre. That was part of a miniature piece composed by Elliot Carter. So we've been conducting a kind of hearing-based analysis of music which has been recorded but primarily exists in the acoustic realm. Let's look at some of the possibilities of our peculiar medium now, electronically manipulated sound. We can use the same checklist: loudness, timbre, pitch, pulse, and if we have time, we'll get into a bit of phrasing or form. Turning back to the 23-year-old Harim Eldab, I don't know for sure, but I think he's using just one voice here. He recorded only one voice. And subsequently, I suspect he used a lot of multi-tracking, re-recording, each one with some variation. Let's look at the timbre here. For example, the voice. We instantly recognize it as a voice. You recognize vowels even if you don't know the language being sung. And the vocal profile has a particular timbral signature that's different from the guitar or from that of a swana or that of a snare drum. But then there are aspects of timbre which are manipulated by Eldab himself. There's an amazing intensification here. It's around the last 25% of this 2-minute segment. These are probably combination resonances of the vocal timbre itself, but intensified further by the resonant frequency of the room, or by selecting certain resonant frequencies in the re-recording. Those resonance frequencies of the recording itself get heightened and become flute-like. What about the pitch realm? The layering of the voices, combined with essentially the processing of the reverb, create a simultaneity of pitch, a cluster or a harmony. Combined pitch. As with the swana, there are subtle connections between longer notes, between the primary pitches, and in this case also bends, partly a function of linguistic phonetics, partly a function of expression of the voice. Whether we notice these subtle details at first or not, we would probably be aware if they weren't there. The performance would seem like it was missing something. What about pulse and rhythm in this piece? We probably can't exactly tap our foot to it, even if we focused on one voice. But each voice, like the swana again, has some fast notes, some long notes, some rests. Looking at it another way, each layer is, I would say, intentionally not aligned with the other, creating a multiple-voiced soundscape in which one comes in and recedes while the other, while the next one comes in and recedes. Some are closer, some sound further, independently, but somehow all interacting. This type of multi-voice, literal multi-voice quality in music, is sometimes called counterpoint in music theory. What about form? There are some very striking moments, for example, a cumulative effect is generated when everything pauses. That's incredibly significant, and that silence is very powerful. There may even be semantic, meaning-based reasons for it. Please keep in mind that this is only 1/10 of the whole piece, the original composition lasting 20 minutes. So in terms of pacing, it makes sense for a 20-minute piece, but perhaps for you, writing a piece of a couple minutes duration, you might want to think about a different kind of pacing, a different kind of structure, introducing variation in a more timely manner. I'd like to leave you with another piece. We don't have time to talk about it, but I'd like you to listen and ask yourself similar questions. This is a piece by Pauline Oliveros called A Little Noise in the System. And you can ask yourself the same questions. How do the parameters change together or independently over time? Loudness, timbre, pitch, what kind of pitch exists? Can you sing it back at any moment or not? Pulse or durations or static qualities, irregularities. And what constitutes a phrase? How do we describe a form? I'm just giving you some short segments here. If you wish to listen to the entire 30-minute piece, you may. This example, as well as the Aldab example, are taken from albums you can access directly from the website of a record label called Sub Rosa, based in Belgium. They have a remarkable collection of concrete, experimental, and noise music from 1920s to the 2010s. See you later.